Please take your Bibles and turn to Daniel 3. I was telling somebody earlier that this is really the easiest chapter to teach. It's a straightforward narrative, and there are two or three issues along the way. And yet, with a straightforward reading of it, if you didn't pause to think, hey, what about such as, you wouldn't deal with that. But we'll stop and ponder those a little bit. Do we have pictures, Aaron?
We do.
We do. Okay. Let me get my little pointer gizmo. All right. We only got five pictures tonight. So, my daughter's equipment. She does. How do you do this? It's what's the thing that she does, Aaron? It's not Photoshop. She has some kind of a stylist that she, anyway, but her stylist died, so I don't have artwork from her this time. Hopefully we'll do that next time. It says, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose breadth was 60 cubits and whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth was 6 cubits. And he set it in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Okay, right there at the beginning, we have some issues. Now you would think, well, this is just a big statue. What's the big deal? This will come down to logistics and possibilities. If this thing is solid gold, we've got some problems. Because there probably wasn't that much refined gold in existence in the world at that time. I actually have all this. It's fascinating what you can do if you have a little bit of time in the internet. All the gold in existence today would make a cube that's only 20 meters square. If you were to take all the refined gold in the world today. And over half of that is since the California Gold Rush. A huge amount of gold came out of California. And so we have an issue with that. And then we also deal with the weight of gold. Let's see. I think I put in your notes how much this thing would weigh. Yeah, 4,400 tons. Some of you may remember when we were doing Desert Storm. They went across the desert from Jordan to Baghdad, to the populated areas of Iraq. And people got lost, not because there were mountains and so on. This is because of dust storms and the fact that you look off to every... You can do a 360 and everything looks the same. It's this big pan desert of red. Of red dust. When you get into Iraq, one of the things that's fascinating about excavations of Babylon and so on is that nothing is made out of stone. Almost nothing is made of stone. Why at the ruins of Babylon, which is only like 50 miles south of modern Baghdad, why isn't anything made of stone? Somebody talk to me. Why isn't anything made out of stone? There isn't any! It is mud, or dried mud, as far as the eye can see. Now you go up to Nineveh, and you got some hills and stuff, but that's quite a ways to the north. Where Baghdad is, and where Babylon was, it's just flat can be, and it's just river silt. From back when the Euphrates was weaving back and forth through that whole region. That's all it is. And so everything was made of a brick, baked brick. And the Google the Ishtar Gate when you get home. That was the main entrance for the city of Babylon. It was beautiful, and they've made. If you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City today, they have a giant reproduction of the thing. It's gorgeous, and the whole thing was lined with glazed baked brick. They didn't have any stone, and so anything that they do that has reliefs on it or anything else like that has to be made out of carefully baked brick with glazes on it. Otherwise, the whole thing would crumble. This is also why the walls, well, there's several reasons, but one of the reasons the walls of the ancient cities in that region are shaped like this. All right, they've got slope sides, much steeper on the outside than it is on the inside. But the reason is the thing is made out of mud. And if we get a lot of rain or anything else, it begins to disintegrate. And also, it does not have as much strength under the pressure of the weight of what's above it as stone would. And so you have these massive, hugely thick walls. The walls of Babylon were about anywhere from 150 to 300 feet high, depending on who you talk to, and more than that thick. So these great, big, huge, enormously massive structures. So we run into this thing that is tall and skinny. And we have seen all different sorts of descriptions, because there is nothing left of this. I will tell you this, that in this, the plain of Dura is not necessarily a specific location that we could say, oh, it's right over here. There are several places that deal with it because it's a descriptive name. And so we have to get some conjectures. Generally understood to be probably a few miles south of Babylon. Because the whole region is a plain in the plain of Dura. In the province of Babylon. So it's in the same province, but it's not in the city, and probably a little bit to the south of there. They have found in that region, there's a couple of possibilities, and possibly neither one of them is the case, but they have found a couple of very large platforms that were built, again, out of baked bricks and so on, that could have been the platform for something like this. And what did it look like? Okay, let's get some pictures up here on the screen. All right, this is actually a stele, S-T-E-L-E, from that region. It is made of stone. It is in, I think it's in the British Museum now. The thing is about 16 or 17 feet tall, which when you consider the fact that they had to haul this rock for who knows how far in order to be able to get it to that location was quite an undertaking. But you can see it's basically an obelisk. Now, the Egyptians had the things that were basically what our Washington Monument is modeled after. And there's a number of those that have been taken all over the place, different parts of the world that are in museums. The British have took a number of these when they ruled Egypt. And there's quite a few of them still in Egypt. So the idea of an obelisk is a possibility. And you can see that they've got the carvings on there. The Romans did the same thing with pillars. And so the design on the thing would be a story that they would build one of these things and you have pictures of their conquests and the loot that they would bring back. And so it's a possibility that it would be something like that with an image of, with the relief of it on the side of the thing. It's not necessarily carved out of things so it looks like a giant statue, but rather has a relief on it. That's a possibility. How in the world could they build something that is 90 feet tall? Okay, let's look at the next picture. Because this one's 16. All right. The Egyptians built stuff that was pretty big. This big here, this big statue here, used to be vertical. Used to be vertical. And seeing the people there, you get an idea of how monstrously big this thing is. There were a number of statues like this in Egypt. Now, of course, these things are 3,000 years old. And the Egyptians had lots of stone. So therefore it was, this was made out of carved stone and it's pretty durable. Granted, it's not vertical anymore. I mean, busted off the ankles. But they have, there are several large statues, in the Middle East that are giant feet. Just the feet. Now why do you think they were worshiping feet? Why are there these giant statues of feet in different parts of the Middle East? Somebody talk to me.
There was a big statue.
Yeah! That's all that's left! He broke off at the ankles. And the rest of it's been, you know, used for other things. They, you know, chopped it up, carved it into other pieces of needed material. And what was left was the ankle. So you get an idea, there used to be a pretty substantial statue here. All right, next one. Okay, this is not in existence today. This only stood for, I think, 40-some-odd years. This is the Colossus of Rhodes. Rhodes is an island off of the southwest coast of what is now Turkey. And our Rhode Island is named after that island. It was an independent Greek city-state at the time. And about 250 BC or thereabouts, they decided, let's build a giant statue to the sun god, and we're going to put it right at the entrance to our harbor. And they did. They made this thing. It was 110 feet tall. There is nothing of it left. But the Romans still knew a couple hundred years later, there were still pieces of that lying around. It was never rebuilt. But they saved a lot of the pieces for a long, long time. And so there's a lot of ancient records that go, that are multi-generational and outside of the city of Rhodes and so on that say, yeah, this thing was real and it was there. So they built this thing and it's supposed to have straddled the entrance to the harbor. Now whether or not it actually did, we're not sure. But again, they were able with engineering in the day to be able to build stuff like this. So the idea of something that is 6 feet, or 6 cubits wide and 90 or 31 tall is not beyond the realm of possibility. Where do I have the dimensions? It's 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. So it's not, and depending on whether you make it as an obelisk or even as a statue, it's not beyond the realm of possibility as far as the engineering feats of the day. They were able to build stuff like this. All right, so Nebuchadnezzar makes this thing. We don't know when this happens. It's obviously after chapter 2 because we'll have Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as fairly high government officials in the province of Babylon in the situation here. And also, it has to be before chapter 4. By the way, you would think, well, doesn't that make sense? Not all Bible prophetic books are in chronological order. Jeremiah, for example, is not in chronological order. But Daniel seems to be for the most part, but not always. There's one or two chapters that are off, but not these three. And so we have this gigantic statue that Nebuchadnezzar builds. What is it an image of? Some have said, well, it's an image of himself, of course. After all, he is the image, the head of gold. And some of the commentators run amok with that. Not necessarily. The Babylonians were not as keen on emperor worship as the Romans would be later on. They had a very high regard for their own pantheon of gods. And the pantheon of gods in Babylon, there were certain gods that they favored above others, and so they had to have an empire, a fairly new empire, and requiring all the high officials to gather together to pay homage to the god that this statue represents would be paying homage to the key city of the empire, which would be Babylon. So, could have been Nebuchadnezzar himself, but probably not. So he makes this gigantic statue. It's impressive. It is probably covered with either gold leaf or gold plate, which in itself is, that's a lot of gold. That's a lot of gold. The Dome of the Rock, in Jerusalem. You see that, the gold dome? You know why that looks like that? Because it's covered with gold. And it is the responsibility of the king of Jordan to maintain that thing. So the Israelis don't have to monkey with it. That is the responsibility of the king of Jordan to maintain that. And any time he has to redo that, it costs well over $1 million in gold to refinish that roof. And it has to be done every once in a while. So to build this gigantic image that is 90 feet by 9 feet, regardless of what it was shaped like, whether actual statue or an obelisk or whatever it might be, is still a huge amount of money. But it's going to be on a very flat plain, a gorgeous, almost illuminated landmark. As the sun shines on it, it's going to be, what is that sparkling, shining thing over here? The sun's over here. What in the world is this? Well, that's the statue that Nebuchadnezzar made. And so this also being gold is going to demonstrate the wealth and the splendor of the kingdom. There's been a number of places, the ancient kings of Burma, I say ancient, the kings of Burma before the British took over, would line their palaces with gold. And whenever you had a new king, he would build himself a new palace because the one his dad had and the one that his grandfather had were not sufficient. I have to build, so they each get a little bit bigger and a little more grand, and then they have a hard time getting gold. But it was against the law to export gold in Burma. You could bring some in, but it could never leave the country, not legally. And so they'd build these bigger and grander things. Gold was, is of course, a sign of wealth. And a number of the palaces from the Renaissance and so on will have rooms and so on gilded to demonstrate the wealth. The Vatican has a fair bit of this kind of thing as well. What's the purpose of this? I think the purpose is to some extent the same thing the emperor worship was in ancient Rome. We are going to create something that is going to facilitate solidarity to the empire. We have a bunch of people that have been conquered. We have all these different ethnic groups, all these different languages, all these different people that have been incorporated into one empire. And we are going to try to create a center point of homage and so on to create fidelity and so forth to the empire. But we're also going to make it very painful if you don't. And the Romans did the same thing on a different level. It says in verse 2 that Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together, and there's a whole long list of different government officials, the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar had set up. We're probably talking about hundreds and hundreds of people. These are the who's who of the Babylonian Empire. Now, the lower officials that actually run the show are probably going to still be on site because they got to keep everything running. But the people who are the high officials. And by the way, most places around the world, even to this day, have fancy costumes. Here in America, we have this rather egalitarian approach that, you know, well, you're no different than we are. We're all equal here in America. Most places around the world don't work that way. And so you have these fancy regalias and different costumes. I mean, anytime, look at the British family. Anytime they're on the balcony, they're all wearing these fancy, fancy duds that nobody out there in the crowd is wearing. They have these fancy uniforms. I mean, he's wearing all these things with a zillion and a half badges and medals and stuff. Well, what did you do to earn those? Well, I'm the king. I'm the prince. I'm the guy. Now, I may have actually earned a few of these things, but for the most part, they're decor. I mean, would you wear the red coat that the king wears in public? No. But he gets to because he's the king. And so all these different people are wearing their finery that are tied to their office. So you would have this large crowd of hundreds of people all wearing these rather ornate and sometimes gaudy uniforms that are tied to their office. And they're all there. They've all been summoned to the dedication. And of course you can't say no. We are dealing, of course, with an absolute monarch. But something I think is going to be sprung on them after they arrive. Verse 3. And the princes and the governors and the captains and by the way, I don't know if you've noticed this, but it's a cultural thing. How many times in the Old Testament especially you have repetition of something that you've just read? And it's to make sure, because not everybody had a copy of this stuff, so they would repeat things over and over again, so you got it in your head what you heard. Because you can't look down the page and say, oh, it's right there, because you didn't have the page. Then the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together under the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood. You got this gigantic group of people, several hundred people, all standing in formation, almost like a marching band or a bunch of soldiers doing field exercises. And a herald cries out. They're all there in formation, all in their different regalias, their different uniforms, respected uniforms. A herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded. Now that you're here, now that you're all here, now that you've all traveled from your various parts of the empire and you have arrived here, and we are here at this grand dedication, we are going to make a demand of you now that you are here. And by the way, where it says, oh, peoples, nations, and languages, that is a theme that you will see in Daniel several times. This is the first time it's mentioned. That at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king hath set up. So when the orchestra sounds, you will bow. Anybody here ever take sackbut lessons when you were younger? Just wondering. When we dealt with the introduction of the book of Daniel, we mentioned that there are, one of the things that liberals latch onto is there are several Greek words in Daniel, which indicates that this thing was actually written several hundred years after the purported date. The Greek words are musical instruments. There are a number of words in this chapter, and they're mostly in this chapter, that don't occur anyplace else in Daniel. They don't occur anyplace else in the Old Testament. And some of them don't occur anyplace else in anything we've found anywhere. And a couple of them are, at least one of them, are musical instruments. You got this list of things, and if you read different translations, look at this, you'll see that the list varies quite a bit. Because on a lot of these, it's best guess. There's a few of them we know what they are. So rather than having a redundancy, okay, we know what this one is, so this one can't be that. We don't have two trumpets or two French horns or whatever the case may be. And so it's guess, and then also some of the things that were known to have been used in that place. So we got two more pictures. One of them is going to maybe surprise you if you haven't read any newer translations. What in the world is the guy on the right playing?
A goat blue.
Oh, a what?
A goat blue.
A goat blue. Well, that's what it's made out of. It's made out of a goat skin. Somebody said potato. I wish I could grow potatoes that big. Kind of looks like a big potato. It's a bagpipe. It's a bagpipe. We often think of bagpipes equals Scotland. Bagpipes are played in a lot of places around the world. And they don't all look like the fancy ones that you see parading around with the guys in skirts, okay? This is obviously a homemade version made out of a goat skin. And bagpipes have been around for several thousand years. They still play them in the Middle East, obviously. This is a fairly current picture. And so most newer translations will put bagpipe on the list of the instruments here. Very likely the case. Use your imagination. Pretend he's wearing plaid. You know, you get the idea. So we have this, and by the way, when I mentioned that some of the Greek words are here, almost all the Greek words are here, number one, Greek mercenaries were very, very common going back at least to the 7th century B.C. And we know they were used extensively in the Middle East, even prior to the Persian Wars. One of the things that people will take with them, soldiers especially, will take with them when they travel are their musical instruments. Sometimes they're small, but they'll take their musical instruments. They make them on site. And so if it becomes popular in a local area, it will catch on and remain in that area even after the immigrants are gone. And some of these musical instruments were Greek imports that stuck around in Babylon. All right, the next one is something that was used in Babylon for ages and ages and ages. Some allusions to things like this in the Psalms. There was a lot of different stringed instruments. We often translated harp or lyre or something like that, and it gives us an idea of what's available today, what we do today. They have actually found in some of the, well preserved in a few of the tombs and so on, some of these things actually made out of wood that are still intact. So we have a good idea of what they actually looked like. Different stringed instruments, some with sounding boards on them, which is sort of the predecessor to our lute and guitar. Played a little differently, but you get the same idea. And so stringed instruments, wind instruments is what you have here. There's a couple of translations that will actually throw drum in here as well. Again, some of them we don't know what they are because this is the only place where the word occurs. We know it's a musical instrument, but we're not sure. The point is, and it doesn't really matter, because what we've got here is we have a band. We have an orchestra that is going to start playing, and that's the cue to bow. The reason I went through all this stuff is just to let you know that what the liberals latch onto, the people who are Bible deniers latch onto, are silly things to try to prove their point. Oh, there's Greek words. Yes, but there are a couple of musical instruments, and they were probably brought in by the mercenaries that had been in Babylon for 200 or 300 years by this point. When you bow, or when you hear, then you bow. And verse 6, here we run into the issue. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. The burning fiery furnace is probably right there. Let's assume that it doesn't matter how we envision the statue. The fact of the matter is that however it was built and so on, there's a lot of metal, a lot of gold involved. Gold is very, very heavy. You don't want to be transporting large plates of this. They don't have railroad. They're either going to be a bunch of people carrying it, or you're going to have carts doing it, and they don't have asphalt either. So if it's really heavy, the wheels are going to press down into the ground. You have to bring it over in small components. If we're going to be making large plates of this to fasten onto a structure of some sort, even if it's plating an obelisk, it'd be much easier in the day and age, dealing with the transport they had, to bring smaller pieces to the site and then melt them and have them form into what we need on site. On site. So what they would have built here on site is a gigantic furnace to be able to melt the gold, to turn it into what they needed to turn it into. A furnace in the day, and by the way, if you Google this thing, you get about, you know, more different designs than I have fingers for. One that was described to me many, many years ago, and judging from what they used it for and how it was used, I thought fit the, and the building materials and so on they had at the time, I think fit the situation the best. All right? The Babylonians built these great huge monuments that were made out of the mud brick. A furnace is going to, and by the way, they had kilns, brick kilns, all over the place in the region in order to be able to fire the bricks so they'd be sturdier and could be used for different materials than simply sunbreak bricks. I mentioned the walls that were pitched about like this. You can make them as long as you wanted to. The walls of Babylon were miles long. But you could have this wall, and you can make it go as, you know, as long as you went this way too, you could make it go as high as you wanted, as long as you had enough labor and so on. And so what they would do is they would have, let's say we've got, and this would probably work for what they were talking about, let's say we got a wall as long as from this wall to the back wall of the lobby. Okay? Maybe, I'm not sure how far that is, what is that, about 70 feet. 70, 80 feet. And then you've got these big pitched walls. The steeper wall would be on the inside. The outside wall could be long enough so it could actually be a ramp that people could walk up. You could put stairs on it. And so you have this thing and it comes up and let's say it's 25, 30 feet high. You have another one on the other side. So what you've got is you've created slope walls on the outside, a narrow chasm on the inside that might be 4 feet, 5 feet, 6 feet wide. You would have fuel in there. You'd pack the fuel on one end of this. You would have several giant bellows on the outside of this thing to do this. They could pour more fuel on from the top. And then you could have guys working the opening with long, kind of like a glass blowing furnace. And they could work the thing from the outside. That's probably something very similar to what we had. Because it's baked mud brick, it probably was not enclosed over much of the top. So it's narrow at the top, but open, and then sloped down the sides. Also, those who were positioned right, got the middle aisle here, could look straight down the middle and see all the way through the inside. This is nearby. So when he says, whosoever will not bow will be thrown into the fiery furnace, it's right there. And probably, for the sake of appearances and so on, whether it was being needed at that time or not, probably stoked a little bit even as they spoke. To create, you know, we won't have to wait for this thing to get fired up. If you don't cooperate, it's ready to go. Now, verse 7, therefore at that time, when all the people, here's the orchestra, starts up, they heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, the languages, fell down, remember, because they were all standing, and worshiped the golden image which Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Okay, several hundred people, all of a sudden, they're all bowing down. They're all on their elbows and their knees, bowing down in the direction of this giant statue. Except for three very glaring exceptions. Named Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Everything I read always devotes at least a paragraph to where was Daniel. he's not mentioned in chapter 3. At the end of chapter 2, what position did Daniel get?
Administrator over all the other administrators.
Yeah, he's the top dog. He's basically the prime minister. And I suspect that Nebuchadnezzar, there's several different possibilities. I think the most likely one is that Nebuchadnezzar had been working with Daniel personally for years. Knew his personal fidelity, trusted him, and therefore he was not required to be there. Some others have said, well, he was sick, he was out of town on business. You know, he can throw out all kinds of things. The fact of the matter, he wasn't there. But I think the first one is the most likely. Because of his high position as the highest guy, he wasn't required to be there. He got an exemption. But his three friends were not. And by the way, we don't see Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego after chapter 3 because there's a big block of time between chapters 3 and 4. And they probably either retired or have passed away since by that time. But here they're having to do the right thing without Daniel there as their leader and comrade. Everybody bows except 3. Verse 8. By the way, chapter 3 mirrors chapter 6 with the lion's den situation because the guys who are going to be talking here in verse 8 are driven by the same motive as the guys in chapter 6. Wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. The Chaldeans there's two aspects in which Chaldean is used. One is that they are a particular class of soothsayers, magicians, astrologers, whatever. And then also they are an ethnic group. In this particular case, it's almost certainly used as an ethnic group. The king, Nebuchadnezzar, is a Chaldean. This is the tribe, this is the group of people that are the highest of the high. These are the people that are ruling the roost. These are the princes. This is the ethnic group that the king comes from. This is the preferred exalted people, the privileged class. We have a big problem if you're a Chaldean. You have something that is really grating you. It is a burr under your saddle. I can't do much about Daniel. He's the king's favorite. And he's a Jew. And he's not a Chaldean. And he's the prime minister. And he's a young guy. And he leaped over all of us and got that position, and there's nothing we can do about it. And then, because of his position, he got his three buddies to have the three plum jobs, the choice jobs, here in the province of Babylon. So we have foreigners who don't worship our gods as our bosses. And they're relatively young guys. And so we have a great deal of jealousy. We have a great deal of prejudice that is driving this accusation. They spake and said unto King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Long live the king. Okay, it's the standard protocol. You approach the guy, you got to say this. Thou, O king, as if he needed to be reminded, but, you know, they like to hear the sound of their own voice, I suppose. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worship shall be cast into the fire, burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews. There are certain Jews whom thou, oh, we gotta be careful, whom thou, we're gonna throw a little personal responsibility to Nebuchadnezzar, hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon. These three high-ranking guys, guys that you know, guys that you have met. You know them by name, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. This is a personal affront against you, O king. They have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, which was true, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. That is true as well. We saw last time that Nebuchadnezzar has anger management issues. And so verse 13 says, Nebuchadnezzar in his rage and fury. One of the interesting things about people in his position is they have never been personally insulted. They have never been defied. They are always right and they are always the boss. And any time that is ever challenged, it's so totally outside of their experience and it is such a blow to their inflated ego that they overreact. He is in rage and fury and he commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and they brought these men. Because they got this huge, again, huge number of people, all standing in at attention, all had bowed, except for this guy and this guy and this guy here. They may have been standing shoulder to shoulder, probably were, but they didn't bow. And so they were brought. It is speculation as to whether or not when they got the summons in the first place to be there, if they knew what this was all about. I'm inclined to think they probably did. We need to make up our minds in advance that we are going to do the right thing regardless of the circumstance and regardless of the cost. There are certain things that I'm going to do. There are certain things I'm not going to do. And it doesn't matter what it costs me. That's just what I'm going to do or not do. It's called godly character. It's called obedience to a higher authority. Nebuchadnezzar gives these guys, they're brought before the king, and he gives them a second chance. And I think this is for three reasons. Number one, he has found these guys, because probably a number of years have passed since their appointment to their role and the present. And so he has found them to be very useful. They are good at what they do. And very hard to find quality, loyal, hardworking, honest employees, especially in higher government positions. And then also, he was the guy that appointed them. So if these guys are compliant, we've got no problem. And also giving them a second chance and with the, maybe they misunderstood, maybe there was some issue here. Now, understand that also that chapters 2, 3, and 4 are the education of Nebuchadnezzar. Are the education of Nebuchadnezzar. We'll find out the other part if you haven't known already when we get to chapter 4. I personally believe that Nebuchadnezzar became a worshiper of the true God by the time we get to the end of chapter 4. But it took a lifetime. Because he's an old man when we get to chapter 4. And he's a young man in chapter 2. So somewhere in between, the first time he learns is that Daniel's God can do something that the Babylonian gods can't. And he is the Most High God. So he is greater than all of my assistants, all my other people, all my committee of Chaldeans and soothsayers and all these other guys that I rely on to give me answers. Daniel and his God are greater than anybody else. He's about to find out that Daniel's God, the God of Judah, the God of these three, same God, is greater than he is. Which is going to be a startling revelation. I mean, he may acknowledge in the back of his head that he's worshiping the local gods, but they're just, you know, blocks of stone or metal, and they don't do anything. They just sit there. Here's a God who does stuff. And the God that does stuff overrules Nebuchadnezzar and demonstrates it. So this is a major reset in his thinking that's going to take place here in chapter 3. He's going to give him a second chance. He says in verse 14, is it true? That's translated a variety of different ways, but it basically comes out to mean the same thing. Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now, and he probably knew that to be the case. He's had work with these guys before. He may or may not have known about their dietary change. That was an agreement made without his knowledge necessarily. But he knows about Daniel and his God. And he also knows that Daniel and these guys came from the same place, they worshiped the same God, and that these guys were put in high government positions by himself. Now, if you're already at what time ye hear, and by the way, also, this puts Nebuchadnezzar also in a no-win situation. He can't back down. Not without losing face, which a guy in his position, you don't want to do. At what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the image which I have made, we're all good. But if you worship not, you shall be cast the same hour, in other words, as soon as it can be arranged, in the midst of the burning fiery furnace, and then we have this. Here's the direct challenge. And who is that God which shall deliver you out of my hands? The implication is, there isn't one. Your God may be able to predict the future. Your God may be able to tell you what I dreamed on my bed. But your God can't intervene my command. He can't counteract. He can't contradict. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, having made up their minds already, answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. We don't have to have a discussion. We're not going to have a little meeting and decide what we're going to do. We've already made up our minds. If it be so that our God whom we serve is able to deliver us out of the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O God, or O King, whether we die or not, if we be absent from the bodies, we be present with the Lord. So if we're delivered from your hand and allowed to live, then God has delivered us. And if we die, God has delivered us. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which you have set up. There is no discussion. There is simply a declaration. No effort to strike deals. No compromise. All right, Nebuchadnezzar blew a gasket earlier, and now I think he cracked the block. Nebuchadnezzar, full of fury. I love how this is phrased in the King James. How would you say this? You know, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That means he did this. You know, his face was all just distorted in his rage. He sort of went from a bright pink to deep purple. And he commanded they should heat the furnace. It says 1/7 times more than it was wont to be. There was not a dial or a gauge on this thing. The idea here, and you'll see the word seven used this a few other times in scripture, it's the idea of we're going to make this as hot as we can get it. Which actually killed the guys quicker, but, you know, he's trying to make this look ferocious and nasty. And then they commanded the most mighty men that were in his army, probably his bodyguard that were right there, to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. There's a list of different objects of their clothing in the next little bit here. And that is the other place where you get a lot of these unique words. Some of them, they don't occur anyplace else in the literature that they have discovered thus far. So it's best guess. We saw the steel a little bit ago. We have pictures of what they wore back in those days. And so we know that these guys were tied up. Normally you would strip a prisoner before you executed him because, hey, clothing is expensive and valuable. So they would strip a prisoner before they executed him. In this case, they're in such a hurry, and they want to let the crowd here know that it doesn't matter what position these guys are, it doesn't matter how high they are up in the government, we're going to bind them in their uniforms, tie them up as is, as a demonstration and also to hasten the process. They're going to be tied up as is. And so we have this... It says they were bound, verse 21, in their coats, their hosen, their hats, and other garments. Alright. They were wearing probably flowing, lightweight robes. They wore some sort of a headdress, which was standard at the time. And a number of other things, probably a sash and some other things that would be part with their position in government service. They took them and they tied them up as they were. Now, if I take somebody, let's say average size guy, okay, let's say I take Nathan and I'm gonna tie him up. Well, the furnace is way over here. But we're tying him up. How am I gonna get him from here to there? Well, that's why they got the biggest, strongest guys in the bodyguard to throw him over his shoulder and carry him over to this thing. And I mentioned the sides of the furnace were probably ramps. So you got these big guys climbing the equivalent of 3 or 4 flights of stairs, carrying these guys on their shoulders. With this whole crowd watching what's going on. And every step they go up, it's much more easy to see them because, again, we're dealing with a very flat area. And Nebuchadnezzar has positioned his seat to where he can see the guys climbing up, and then he's going to be able to see them fall down because he's looking straight down the middle. And you can imagine there's this low mumble, but then it gets very quiet as they get toward the top of the steps. And in the meantime, the guys who are operating the furnace have thrown a whole bunch of extra fuel in there, and the bellows are pumping, and the flames are getting higher and higher. And it says in verse 22, wherefore, because the king's command was urgent, the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire slew those men which took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The guys who went over to the edge of the precipice and threw them in were killed by the flames and the heat. And it says at the end of verse 21, that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. They fell down into the furnace. And Nebuchadnezzar, in his cruel, masochistic, sadistic delight, watching, hoping to see these men writhe in pain and then stop moving and then just smolder there in the midst of the fire. But nothing like that happened. Verse 24. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, was astonished. And he rose up in haste and spake, and he probably getting a closer look, and said to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? And they answered and said, true, okay. We all saw it. Everybody can see this. He answered and said, lo, I see four men loose. And of course, if they were tied with rope, that would have burned off. And they're walking in the midst of the fire. And they have no hurt. Nothing has happened to them. They are now free of their bonds, and they're just strolling around in the fire. Okay, and here's, we got to deal with the thing that came up before in our discussion over here beforehand. Okay, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. If you had never read the New Testament, which Nebuchadnezzar never had, because this is him speaking, and it wouldn't exist for another, 600 years, would you have any concept of the Son of God? He's a pagan. The only knowledge he has of the God of Israel is any bits of information he may have gotten from Daniel, possibly these three guys, but much more likely from Daniel. The answer to the question is no. The King James translates it Son of God. If you have a newer translation, it says Son of the Gods. Are we mistranslating something? Are we distorting the original text? No, we're not. Because most of the time where you see the word God, whether we're dealing with Aramaic as it is here or in Hebrew, it's in the plural. Elohim is a plural. It's a plural, most of the time, it's a plural of majesty. If we're talking about pagan gods, plural, it's the same word. But we also deal with the idea of a plural of majesty. That, for example, Roman emperors always spoke of themselves in the plural. We are going to do this. We are going to do this. Because that was an exalted view of themselves. And it carried over in declarations dealing with God by going back far before the Romans. That God was spoken of as a plural. Some have argued that this intimates the idea of the Trinity. Well, the pagans did the same thing with their gods. It's a plural of majesty. Plus, when you deal with the fact that Nebuchadnezzar is the one talking, frankly, a son of the gods makes more sense. Am I saying that it can't be a son of God? No. I'm just saying that it's far more likely to be the one than the other. Especially when we're dealing with who is talking and the time this was. New Testament hadn't been written. The concept of the Son of God was just not there in the Old Testament, at least very, very rare. And we're dealing with a pagan. But whoever this fourth person is, and it may have been the Son of God. It may have been a Christophany. Because this fourth one, he recognizes Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But this fourth one has some sort of a glorious appearance that sets him off from the other three. The form of the fourth is like the Son of God. We cast in three, there are now four, and the fourth one is some sort of supernatural being. Verse 26, then Nebuchadnezzar came probably as near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace as he could without discomfort, and spake and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And then he addresses them as servants of the Most High God. Most High God means that he's higher than Bel. He's higher than Marduk. He's higher than any of the other gods that we may worship here in Babylon. The Most High God. Because here's a God that does that what my gods can't. And he recognized that of Daniel's God earlier. He knows these guys worship the same God as Daniel. He's learning some things. Here's a God who does things. Here's a God who overruled his decree. He says, come hither and come forth and come hither. And they came, they strolled out. And you can imagine, immediately there's a crowd of all these important dignitaries and so on gathered around. They gotta look at what is this? We wanna make sure that there's nothing, we saw them go in, we saw them come out. Did anything happen to them? They gathered together and saw those men upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was the hair of their head singed. I have on more than one occasion burned the hair off the back of my hand, stoking a barbecue too much. Or adding fuel to a fire. Nothing. Neither were their coats damaged, their clothes weren't damaged, neither was the smell of the fire passed onto them. We have a fire pit. And if I'm sitting out there, my wife will, and I'll come back inside, and my wife will go, oh, I know where you've been. You've been sitting by the fire. They didn't even have the smell of it. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, here's a change. He could be angry with the God of Israel, the Most High God, but he recognizes something. That the Most High God overruled him, and therefore he will pay homage to this God. Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel. See, here he calls him an angel. And delivered his servants that trusted in him and have changed the king's word, overruled my decree, and yielded their bodies that they might not worship any god except their own God. This is why they did it, and their God intervened and overruled my judgment against these three and delivered them. And Nebuchadnezzar is going to take it. He's going to accept it. And on top of that, he's going to do this. Therefore, I make a decree that every people, nation, language, which speak anything amiss, if you blaspheme or speak ill against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And by the way, that's a warning to all these dignitaries that are out there. They have been told what would happen if they didn't bow. Now they're going to be told what's going to happen if they say anything amiss about the God who is. That they shall be cut in pieces and their houses shall be made a dunghill. I think it's just as bad, if not worse, than being thrown in the fiery furnace. He says, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. Israel's God, the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, is a God who does stuff. We worship statues. We put our confidence that the passing of the seasons is based on these statues, but they're going to happen just whether I worship those statues or not. But here's a God who does stuff. And we saw it happen. Something supernatural, something that is not, that has no natural explanation. We saw it happen. We saw this God or his emissary intervene and rescue these men. And therefore, we will make a decree that anybody who speaks amiss against this God will be cut in pieces and his house shall be made a dunghill, for there is no God that can deliver after this sort. Not even, he's not going to say it, but not even Bel and Marduk, the gods of Babylon. And then the king promoted these guys. Now, they probably can't get a higher government position. It says in the province of Babylon, and therefore they probably got a raise. Maybe they got finer housing. They've got, you know, higher prestige at the country, got better country club membership, who knows? Got their own golf cart. But whatever they got promoted. So, we're seeing God exalted in Babylon, But the key thing that we're going to be following as we go through the first several chapters here of Daniel is that we see God exalted in the eyes of Nebuchadnezzar. And so chapters 2, 3, and 4 in part are the education of Nebuchadnezzar. Sometimes when we share the gospel with somebody, we deal with these hard-headed, you know, the guy will listen to me, but boy, it's like I'm not making any progress. And you talk to these people, and sometimes years and years go by. But that doesn't mean that something isn't happening. And we've all read stories or heard stories about people that decades went by before finally, and sometimes it was a major upheaval in their lives. Sometimes it was they came down with something that was going to take their lives. But they had had a lot of thought and a lot of stewing about this and a lot of information. And finally, at the end, they say, okay. And I've shared a number of stories. I led a guy to Christ who was diagnosed with leukemia. He was going to be gone in 9 days. I had shared the gospel. Others had shared the gospel with this guy for decades. And as he's sitting in his hospital bed, after he had gotten saved, he looked at me and said, why did I wait so long? Well, it's because a lot of us are hard-headed. And Nebuchadnezzar is going to learn. But Nebuchadnezzar is going to get his diploma in the end. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. Thank you for the lesson of these three men. Thank you for the lesson for Nebuchadnezzar as well. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.